Mark chapter 1 verse 1. The beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. Verse 16. As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. At once they left their nets and followed him. It's believed that the Mark who wrote the Gospel of Mark was someone who worked with Peter, and he recorded the Jesus stories he heard from Peter. This Mark also included himself in the stories in at least one place, as an unnamed young man who ran away without his tunic when soldiers came to arrest Jesus in the garden. In Acts chapter 15, there's an incident involving a young man named Mark. Paul and Barnabas were about to set off on a church planting mission, and Barnabas wanted to bring along this Mark. But Paul objected, because on a previous trip, Mark walked off and quit the mission mid-journey. Paul thought him flaky and didn't want to have anything more to do with him. Mark was someone who blew it with Paul. He badly needed someone to give him a second chance. And Barnabas did just that. He fought for Mark so hard that in the end, Paul went on the trip without them. And Barnabas and Mark set off in a different direction. This time, Mark stuck it out. And sometime later, he ended up working with Peter. Mark turns out to be a very important gospel because it was the first one written. It seems no one thought of writing one before him. And Mark, though short and sparse on details, became the template for Matthew and Luke, who used Mark as an outline and simply filled in extra details. Mark has one goal. He invites the reader to ask, who is this Jesus? Who does what he does, says the things he says, and his way with different people. And if Jesus is really the Son of God, sent by God, then we might want to rethink everything we know about life with God and who God is, and what God is doing in the world. Mark doesn't do a lot of explaining of things, or detailed a lot of what Jesus taught or said in longhand. That's why Luke and Matthew ended up filling in with their gospels. Mostly what Mark does is give us these snapshots of Jesus encountering people. All the stories in the first half built up to a climax in the middle in 8:27, when Jesus asks his disciples, who am I? Who do people say I am? And who do you think I am? And Peter blurted out, you are the Messiah, the one we have been waiting on God for, the one our Bible says is coming to restore us. Now, Peter wasn't repeating something Jesus told him. It's not like Jesus kept drilling into them, remember, if anyone asks, I'm the Messiah. Peter had been rethinking. And he drew a conclusion as someone familiar with what the Bible says. He cross-referenced that to what he saw, having lived with Jesus for 3 years. And he realized Jesus fit the description of the Old Testament prophets. Peter was convinced Jesus was the one sent by God, the one his people had been waiting for to give Israel the new beginning it was yearning for. Because after exile, life had not been the same with God. God felt distant and remote. They had big questions, like, what was God doing, leaving them to fend for themselves under the rule of empire? If there's a common thread to the stories in Mark, was how they were about people all needing to start over with their lives. Have you ever had to start over and reinvent yourself in your life? What did you dream of becoming as a kid? I grew up with a guy in church who, by the time he got to high school, had his life all mapped out. He wrote it all down on a folded up piece of paper he carried around in his shirt pocket. It was like a train schedule, like this would happen at this time. I know this because he showed it to me once. I was never that guy. I was telling a young person recently that every job I've had was an accident. I planned nothing. Or maybe it was that nothing happened according to my plan. Sometime in my teens, I wanted to become an architect, probably for the most cliche reason. My dad had aspired to become an architect, but had to give that up and quit college to tend to the family business when his dad died much too early. My architectural dream also went bust because of a recession in the 80s and there was not much building going on around the time I was ready to apply for architecture school. And I had to rethink my life and find a second choice career. How about you? Are you living your first choice career, your first choice life, the one you dreamed of as a kid? Every Jewish kid in Jesus' time dreamed of becoming a rabbi. Paul was one of the lucky few who got to live the dream when he was accepted by a rabbi into rabbi school. The first mention of him in the Bible was him climbing the social-political ladder on his way to a seat on the ruling council, which controlled everything in Jewish society. For him, he was living his first choice life before meeting Jesus made him question whether his first choice life, going after power and religion and politics, was really what God cared about. And through his relationship with Jesus and the Christians, he rethought his life and found a more meaningful purpose to give his life to. While Paul got to live his first choice life before meeting Jesus, none of the disciples were so lucky. Matthew, who wrote the Gospel of Matthew, was named Levi by his parents, which is the tribal name of the priest who ran the temple, which may say something of the high hopes his parents set for him by giving him that name. But when Jesus met Matthew when he was still Levi, he was far from his dream career as a priest. Instead, he was collecting taxes for the empire, the most hated job in the world. Tax collector was like a swear word for someone who is half crook and half traitor. I can't imagine Levi became a tax collector because he aspired to it, but likely because he had no choice. It was the only thing he could do for a living, and so he had to do it, even if it meant becoming a social outcast and losing all his friends. Before Levi met Jesus, he was living not even his second or third choice life. Maybe tax collecting was his last resort life. Peter's parents called him Simon or Simeon, another tribal name. Luke tells the story of a priest named Simeon, whom he describes as righteous and devout, at a time when the priesthood was full of sellouts. Simeon was the priest Jesus' parents brought Jesus to for a blessing when Jesus was a boy. And the Holy Spirit privileged Simeon by showing him that Jesus was the promised Messiah. So Simeon was a good name for a good priest. And maybe Peter's parents also had high priestly hopes for their baby by giving him that name. If Jesus' rabbi school was anything like the other rabbi schools, then most of the disciples were teenagers, with one older person as head disciple, who also had the responsibility to look out for the younger ones, a kind of vice principal or full-time eldest brother. This would have been Peter. He was the only one married, had his own fishing boat and house. I'm guessing he was around 30 or thereabouts. This means for Peter, the dream of becoming a rabbi was a long time ago. And no rabbi is looking for a 30-year-old new recruit. When Peter met Jesus, he was having a very bad day at work. In that moment, he was feeling like a failure, even in his second choice life. And his reaction to meeting Jesus was, "Oh, get away from me, I'm a very sinful man." What was he carrying around in his soul that was so shameful, so eating away at his self-worth that he couldn't look Jesus in the eye? We can only guess what he had been up to in his life since being rejected by all the rabbi schools, since settling into a second choice life and then maybe deciding there was no point in being his best self anymore. And so in Mark, the gospel about rethinking and starting over begins with Jesus meeting some people who were castaways from their dream life. Because some rabbi had told them they were not good enough for their first choice life. And Jesus invited them to leave their second choice life and start over with a rethink about what is the life they always wanted, the life they had dreamed of living before someone told them they weren't good enough for that. For Peter, the answer to Jesus' invitation was a decisive yes. We're told he dropped his nets, parked his fishing boat, and turned his house into Jesus' headquarters. As he says himself in chapter 10, he gave up everything to follow Jesus. Why didn't Peter need more time to mull it over? I think about what it took for my parents to leave Hong Kong in their 40s to come to this country and start over. Something I don't think I could muster the courage to do when I was their age. So perhaps, before Peter met Jesus, he was already rethinking his life. And he was ready to start over, if only the right offer came along. So as we read Mark again together in this new season, I invite you to be the 13th disciple. But to be fair to the other disciples, you will have to forget everything you know about Jesus. And instead, enter the story with fresh eyes and ears. And see what questions Mark makes you ask about Jesus, about you and your life, and about the way Jesus inspires you to rethink and redo. Because for those of us who have lived long enough, isn't life a series of reinventions anyways, whether we want it or not? Because there are always dead ends and potholes and detours along the way, and we have to constantly course adjust at the least, or even plot a whole other destination. Like now, in COVID time, none of us saw this coming or wanted this interruption to our lives. It occurred to me the other day that I can put life on hold and wait and hope for life to return to normal, which is kind of what I've been doing. Or I can begin to rethink and reinvent life for a new normal, whatever that is going to be. The only thing I know for sure is when life is disrupted by unwelcomed and unplanned things, the only sure thing is that God is with us here, and he offers us his presence and resources when we need to rethink and start again, if that's what we need to do. Jesus found Peter and Levi at work, far from their first choice life. Where did Jesus find you when you first met him? What was going on in your life? Was there some sort of rethinking or reinventing going on? What was your first impression of Jesus? And do you remember your first conversation with him? It was Andrew, Peter's brother, who first met Jesus and then immediately came to bring Peter to Jesus. Did you have an Andrew who introduced you to Jesus? I met Jesus in kindergarten, in the Christian school my parents sent me. I have a vague memory of my first Bible class and the teacher telling us about Jesus. At 4 years old, I had the simplest of faith, because I had no great need at that age, except that God sounded like someone good to have around to talk with. Back then, I had no idea how challenging life would get, how lonely it gets, how disappointing, how painful, and how little control I have over things. And it got tough early, when a few years later, my mom fired my nanny, who was my safe person, because my parents were always working. To this day, there's been no good explanation to why she was let go. Nobody warned me or prepared me for that awful experience. But I like to think God knew ahead of time. And maybe that's why he sought me out in kindergarten, so when painful things happened, I would not be going through it completely alone. Where did God come looking for you in your life? And if Jesus came looking for you today, where would he find you? What circumstances would he find you in? Would he find you happy and satisfied? What would be the most honest thing you want to tell him about what you're feeling at this moment? Are there things you want to do over? Are there things you really want to accomplish or fix while you still can? The first thing Jesus did with his disciples after registration was to give them a nickname. I don't fully know what this is about or how he goes about it, but here's what I find interesting. For Levi, who was forced into his last resort life as a tax collector, who didn't make the grade of all the rabbis who said no to him, who failed to live up to his parents' dream for him when they gave him that priestly name, Jesus renamed him Matthew, which means God's gift. How about that? That regardless of what anyone else thinks, to Jesus, Matthew is a gift. A gift to Jesus, a gift to the world. And for Simon, who has long given up on his dream life, Jesus calls him Cephas in the Aramaic dialect, which translates to the Greek Petros, which means a little rock. There's a pickup truck commercial jingle that says their truck is like a rock. So it makes me think that Peter is called that because Jesus sees that he's reliable. He's a guy you can count on. Peter was certainly taking care of a lot of people in his house with his fishing business. And Peter was about to become the vice principal of Jesus' rabbi school. I wonder how often Peter heard someone thank him for how well he tried to take care of them. How often did his brother Andrew or his mother-in-law turn and said to Peter, "Hey, Peter, thanks for all that you do. We appreciate you." From the moment the disciples said yes to God, Jesus affirmed their best identity. Whereas they may have thought of themselves as failures living their second or third best life, Jesus sees the good in them, not as something they have to work at and become, but the good in them as they are. It didn't matter that Peter regularly acted before thinking through, or tried to walk on water but only to get all wet, or brought a knife to a prayer meeting and cut off someone's ear when Jesus was arrested, or denied knowing Jesus three times when he got scared. Jesus still trusted him and entrusted others to him. Maybe that's why the little in Little Rock, that Peter sometimes bites off more than he can chew. I have heard a lot of preaching that suggests Peter was rash and impulsive. But if he was really so much older than the other disciples, I wonder if he wasn't just being protective of the younger disciples, even from Jesus, like when Jesus started to hint at his impending death on a cross in chapter 8, Peter pulled Jesus aside to scold him for scaring the kids. Was that just Peter being the good eldest brother? If you're the eldest, you know, that's a full-time job, right? I'm the eldest. And one day when I was a teenager, I noticed I was always the one who had to call to order pizza when my mom didn't want to cook. So on that day, I said to my younger brother, you call today. We sat around for 45 minutes starving because he refused to call. So in the end, I had to do it again. My revolution went nowhere. I imagine Peter could never forget there are people depending on him, and he didn't want to let them down. That's why he was the one Jesus asked to carry on, because Jesus told him, I trust you to do that. It's possible Peter was always the first to speak because no one else was speaking. He was the first to try to walk on water because no one else moved when Jesus asked. And for his troubles, he got teased by Jesus, who said, oh, you of little faith, why doubt? Gosh, that sounds so harsh to me. I mean, did Jesus really expect anyone to actually succeed in walking on water? Would any of us not fall in also? And as the 13th disciple, I think I would be relieved I didn't put my hand up and went for it. That it wasn't me looking foolish and all wet. But I always wondered how Jesus said that. I wish I could see his face. Jesus could not have been surprised that Peter fell into the water. So I like to think he said it with a knowing smile, something like, oh, once again, Peter bit off more than he could chew, with predictable results. Like all of us, our Achilles heel is always that we limit what God can do, and what God can do with us by the limits of our own human imagination. But this is not a criticism, it's something to have a sense of humor about, I think. It's the clunky process of human beings learning to see ourselves the way God sees us, and learning to live more fully as the children of God, and not just stumbling through life as victims of circumstances, trying to make do with leftovers. What nickname would Jesus give you, do you think? So that every time he says your name, he is reminding you of the good he sees in you. What is the good in you that you know is there, even though you may not always live up to your own ideals, or even if you're often misunderstood by others who don't see your good intentions? But Jesus sees you, and he trusts you, and he would not hesitate to entrust others into your care. So with their new names, the disciples began their faith adventure as fishers of men, where Jesus kept taking them into and across the Sea of Galilee, which was really a lake, where instead of fish, they were going out to find outcasts. The lake in Mark seems to be some sort of metaphor for the abyss, because seas and water are often a metaphor for death and hell in that time, because people go out to sea and often they don't come back. And on the other side of the lake is where people with various infirmities get cast away from society. The other side of the lake is where there are more people needing a do-over. And Jesus keeps going there with his disciples to heal people and bring them back into life. Because being fishers of men was much more than about the telling people about Jesus sort of evangelism. It was about rescuing the people the world throws away as lost causes, healing them, bringing them life and a new start. And the disciples saw Jesus do so much of this that they retell these miracle stories like it was no big thing. As if it is common for people with disabilities to instantly get healed. Like the way Peter tells the story of Jesus healing his mother-in-law. She was bedridden one moment and up and cooking for them the next. And then off to the next story. Before meeting Jesus, I wonder if the disciples have thought much about the people on the other side of the lake. It's very human to not want to see suffering and where the suffering people are, because it makes us get real about our own pain. Like the way we are tempted to change the channel when they used to run the World Vision programs on TV. That was me changing the channel before I went singing in Brazil and World Vision took us to some slums. The poor homeless people there build illegal lean-tos on steep hills because that's where there's land that nobody wants. Because those hills are always in danger of landslides whenever it rains. They make huts out of mud that have worms in them. Let's just say the worms come out at night and do harmful things to people, especially babies. These slums are everywhere when you look up from the street. Sometimes just around the corner from a well-to-do neighborhood. My first reaction seeing that was, oh, we don't have that at home. But then I realized, is it really that we don't have people that desperate here? Or that I don't see them because I don't want to see them? If we are to look, where do we see barriers to life around us? Like the divide between rich and poor, people who can pay way over asking for a home, versus the people who can't find a place with affordable rent. Like the divide based on skin color, that apparently black people in Canada have been hurt more by COVID than other ethnicities. How has hanging out with Jesus opened our eyes to people and suffering that we have not noticed or wanted to see before? As part of my personal COVID lockdown therapy, I've been watching some older drama from Asia about high school and college sports teams. There's one about a tennis team, a couple about swim teams, and one on diving. The original idea was to escape to a world in simpler, safer times, before COVID, before social protests and unrest, and just watch young people training and striving for excellence, trying to get to the nationals or the Olympics. In these dramas, there is a lot of young, hopeful talk of dreams, of achieving their potential, about things I can remember thinking about when I was their age. But there are also things that derail those dreams. It is drama, after all. Like the swimmer who lost his dad in a car accident. His family could no longer afford his tuition, so he had to leave school and go to work and support family. And there went his first choice life. But there was a moment when I found myself overcome with sadness. Because dream killers are real. They're not just fictional plot lines dreamed up by writers. So much for escape from reality. I thought about what was going on around the world right now, in that part of the world. What is happening with trade wars, political power struggles, and ruthless dictators. All the things happening right now that threaten to rob the hopes and dreams of an entire generation of young people. I became so sad I had to pause for a cry in a conversation with God about how much the world, once again, needs divine intervention. Divine intervention is why Jesus came. It's what Peter and Matthew and the other disciples got when they responded to Jesus with faith. They made a decision to start life over with Jesus. They wanted to see what Jesus had to offer that was better. Faith is us deciding to put our hopes on Jesus and see what happens next. Faith doesn't turn mortals into a superhero. It's not like Iron Man's armor, where the moment we put on faith, we have superpowers and we don't feel fear or doubt or hurt or feel overwhelmed. What Mark shows us is how real people, made of clay, grapple in their relationship with Jesus, how they carry faith as frail human beings. C.S. Lewis says, faith is the art of holding onto things your reason once accepted, despite your changing moods. And what helps us to hold on to faith at the end of the day? It's God. It's what we know to be true about who God is, and whether based on what we know, we choose to lean into Him again. Sometime in the next few months or a year, we're going to have to decide if we trust that a COVID vaccine is safe. And since I don't know anything about the science of vaccines, my decision will come down to if I trust the doctors who tell me it is safe and it will help me survive COVID. My faith in God comes down to if I choose to trust God again, regardless of how freaked out I'm feeling and the scary things that barge into my life. Faith is not really about feeling strong when we're weak or confident when we're scared, though that can happen. But faith is not about how we feel at all. Faith is the decision to lean into God again and rely on Him because we think God can be trusted based on what I know of Him and because we have come to the end of ourselves. Faith is to choose to trust God again in a time when I feel weak and scared and I put my full weight on Him and I wait to see how He holds me up in the process. Faith is less about us and how we feel and more about who we lean on and what we choose to do knowing God is with us and is for us and we don't go it alone. Mark ends abruptly. Maybe for some reason Mark didn't finish it. Or maybe the ending got lost. Nobody knows for sure. But the way it ends leaves the impression that something else is supposed to happen. It is as if there's a space there for us to write in our story, our encounter with Jesus, what we experience when we turn to Him for a do-over in faith, and the new life that we found with Jesus. And thanks to COVID and the new ways we have been coming together on Sundays, we get to share our stories with each other so that we don't just get to know each other better, but also, God can become bigger among us as we tell our stories. Here's a bit from the Jesus Story Book Bible about the first disciples. Jesus left the desert and set about the great rescue. He was going to get God's people back, but first, he needed to find some helpers and friends. He had a lot to do. He would need some people to help him. What would make good helpers, do you think? Clever ones? Rich ones? Strong, important ones? Some people might think so, but I'm sure by now you don't need me to tell you they'd be wrong. Because the people God uses don't have to know a lot of things or have a lot of things. They just have to need Him a lot. One day, Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee when He saw some brothers and friends mending their nets. They were poor fishermen. Jesus called out to them, "Let's go." Peter, Andrew, James, and John looked up at this man on the shore, and they couldn't explain it. Their boats needed to be put away. Their nets needed mending. Fish were still wriggling on the shore. But something about the stranger made them just drop their nets and their fish, leave their boats and everything, and follow him. This God man was like no one they had ever met. When they looked at Jesus, their hearts filled up with a wonderful, forever sort of happiness inside. It was as if they were running free in an open field. Jesus asked 12 men to be his helpers. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, Matthew, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, another James, Simon, Thaddeus, and Judas. Meeting Jesus would change all of them forever. Amen.